centuries ago to save our religion. So this could be a lesson for all people to uphold righteousness, even if it comes at the cost of their lives.
Imam Hussein is the third Shia Imam and the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. The Shia Imam and his companions were killed by the tyrant of their time, Yazid, during the Battle of Karbala some 14 centuries ago. Every year, on the occasion of Arba'in, millions of pilgrims from different countries travel on foot to get to Imam Hussein's shrine. The march is meant to sympathize with the Imam on the pains he endured during the Battle of Karbala.
To us Muslims, participating in the Arba'in march in Karbala is more than a religious duty, but a passion for preserving Imam Hussein's ideology and promoting it among the new generation.
Imam Hussein and his companions were martyred after they refused to pay allegiance to Yazid, for they believed he did not practice Islam as taught by the Prophet Muhammad.
As Imam Hussein said, he rose against Yazid to revive true Islam as introduced by the Prophet Muhammad, who was Imam Hussein's grandfather. By his refusal to pay allegiance to Yazid, our Imam exposed the fact that Yazid was not treading the path of Islam.
This year, from Iran alone, some 3.5 million people took part in the Arba'in Walk in Iraq, in a show of respect for Imam Hussein, who is known among Muslims as a symbol of resistance against tyranny. To Muslims, the Arba'in Walk is of key importance. These people couldn't make it to Karbala this year, but they felt bound to take part in this symbolic march, for they believe by doing this, they would help preserve the legacy of Imam Hussein. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Like the other parts of the Muslim world, Pakistan Shia Muslims observe Arba'in with traditional reverence and solemnity. Thousands of mourners march in streets of Pakistan to pay tribute to Imam Hussein, the grandson of Holy Prophet Muhammad, who embraced martyrdom in Karbala in southern Iraq some 1400 years ago. The battle was fought between the faithful followers of the third Shia Imam, Hussein bin Ali, and Yazidi forces on the plains outside the modern Iraqi city of Karbala, which is home to Imam's shrine, a sacred sanctuary for Shia Muslims.
We believe the legacy of Imam Hussein is a timeless source of lessons about humanity and loyalty that exceeded his time and place. The love for Imam is endless and will continue until the end of this world.
The Islamic New Year, started from the month of Muharram, has been observed all over Pakistan with great dedication. Muharram is the month of mourning for the lovers and faithful followers of Imam Hussein.
We're here to pay tribute to Imam Hussein, his family and his companions who sacrificed their lives to save Islam. The mission of Imam Hussein is the mission of truth, peace and justice.
Similar mourning processions and religious gatherings were held in all major cities and towns all across Pakistan with special security arrangements.
The mourners and religious scholars have highlighted the teachings of Imam Hussein and his uprising against Yazid in Karbala. They regard the tragedy of Karbala as the symbol of resistance against oppressors. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Muslims in Nigeria are also marking Arba'in with a symbolic trek over a long distance. Danjuma Abdullahi reports.
Hundreds of Shia Muslims took to the roads, trekking and chanting to mark 40 days since the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein and scores of members of his family and his companions in Karbala in present-day Iraq. The trekkers condemned Yazid and his army for the gruesome killing of the third Shia Imam.
We commemorate this Arba'in in order to show our love and tribute to Imam Hussein and his household and his right companions that sacrificed their life entirely in order to save Islam.
Men, women and children joined millions of other Shia Muslims to participate in the symbolic trek, which was organized by Nigeria's Islamic movement. The trek is held around the globe every year as part of mourning rituals for Imam Hussein. They praise the leadership qualities of Imam Hussein.
He's a leader of justice and humanity. He brought justice and humanity in the world entirely. Why? During the Battle of Karbala, he stand before the oppressors. I told them that he stand here not because of his priority, not because of everything, rather to bring justice.
Despite the heavy rain, the marchers trekked for several kilometers and ended their walk here in Suleja.
Prayers were offered here for Imam Hussein, members of his household, and his loyal companions who were martyred at the Battle of Karbala. Danjuma Abdullahi, Suleja.
Every year, millions of pilgrims from all over the world take part in the Arba'een March in Iraq, walking the distance between the holy cities of Najaf and Karbala. In this religious gathering, pilgrims commemorate the third Shia Imam, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, who is a symbol of love and sacrifice. Hussein and his 72 companions were martyred in the Battle of Karbala in southern Iraq in the 7th century after fighting chivalrously for justice and resisting succumbing to the tyrant of his era. The modern example of Imam Hussein's resilience against oppression is Palestine. On the way of the pilgrims marching to Holy Karbala, a monument incarnating Al-Aqsa Mosque grabs pilgrims' attention. There is a convoy named the Al-Aqsa Corps, which receives thousands of pilgrims from various countries during Arba'een. Al-Aqsa Corps convoy forges a direct link between the oppression inflicted upon Imam Hussein and the one suffered by the Palestinian people in the face of the Zionist regime.
Undoubtedly, the issue of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and his oppression is similar to the current oppression against the Palestinian nation. This nation is facing organized terrorism, which is led and carried out by Israel, the fundamental enemy of Islam and Muslims. Therefore, we say the plight of Palestinians is very similar to the story of Karbala. If you want to rise to the aid of the Palestinian cause, we must rise from the origins of the movement of Imam Hussein.
What's happening in Palestine today refreshes the memories of what took place around 1400 years ago. The oppression Palestinians are suffering at the hands of Israeli occupying forces is today's version of Imam Hussein's resistance against the second Umayyad caliph, Yazid.
Palestinian people, since a century, are facing a war from the imperialism and Zionism, ethnic cleansing, killing women, children, massacres. Many massacres were made in Palestine, in Palestinian villages, and prisoners. 1 million Palestinians went to prison since in the past 30 years. 1 million. So Palestine today is Karbala of today, of this time.
Within the big tent that belongs to Palestinians is an exhibition that displays photos of Palestinian martyrs killed by Israeli forces. This, alongside other organized activities, has attracted the attention of younger generations.
As our leader Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei says, the liberation of Quds will begin from Palestine with God's help. God willing, nothing can hinder us, Iraqis and the Arab and Muslim community in general. We gather around the axis of Hussein, peace be upon him. Today in the Arba'een Walk and in this mawqif, it was shown that Hussein's saga is being honored by our Palestinian brothers. This is a clear reason that depicts the universal aspect of Imam Hussein, showing that he is not specific to a particular sect or religion or group. He's for everyone.
One of the lessons learned from Imam Hussein's revolution is that death with dignity is better than a life with humiliation. And the resistance demonstrated by the brave Palestinian nation in the face of Israeli crimes and oppression is actually similar to that.
Every year during Arba'een, we are reminded that the lovers of justice and liberation from oppression are in the majority. And this mawqif is trying to educate people about the atrocities against the Palestinian people and to teach especially the younger generation what the Palestinian cause is. Mahdi Abbasian, Karbala.
Miles covered on foot. Mourners walked from their homes all the way to the city center in Karachi to join the main procession to show their love for Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam.
Mourners have gathered here to commemorate the 40th day after the anniversary of Imam Hussein's martyrdom and to show their respect for a man who sacrificed his life but did not pledge allegiance to the tyrant of his time, Yazid.
The mourners chanted, "Stand like Hussein against Yazid of your time."
People, you are looking there. There are a large amount of people here. People love Imam Hussein. This is the day which the family of Imam Hussein came from Sham to Karbala.
It's a lesson for many because his sacrifices for Islam and what he has done is something we should remember for all of our lives.
Abu Abdullah sacrificed for the Islam, for the people of Islam, for the people of the world, for the peace, for the humanity, for the justice.
The mourners recited elegies to remember the hardships of Prophet's grandson and the tragedy of Karbala and protest against tyrants of the time.
We are here to tell the oppressors that we are not a minority, we are a majority here. And we always prove them wrong every year in Arbain, every year at this day we prove them wrong that we are a minority. We are the biggest majority in the world and we will stay the biggest majority.
Imam Hussein alayhi salam sacrificed his life and his family for this save the Islam, the message of Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and become the voice of the voiceless people of humanity.
It is still relevant because it was such a great sacrifice on his part, because he sacrificed his family, his children for the sake of our religion, for the sake of Allah. So for that reason it is really relevant to us.
Those who participated in the mourning ceremony say they are inspired by Imam Hussein's philosophy of freedom. His devotees and die-hard followers believe his legacy will remain a ray of hope for ages to come. Until then, millions across the globe will keep flocking Karbala to refresh their allegiance with their Imam. Muhammad Turi, Karachi.
People across Afghanistan are commemorating the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, known as Arba'in. People gather in mosques on this day and hold mourning ceremonies to pledge their loyalty to Imam Hussein and remember his legacy, which is resistance against arrogance and oppression.
Mourning gatherings in mosques and other places is not merely an emotional act, but it is a mixture of human values. People gather to raise their awareness and passion for righteousness, which is also the legacy of Imam Hussein.
On Arba'in, the poor, as well as those who attend the mourning ceremonies, are fed for free. The march has now decreased due to the Taliban's new security measures to prevent attacks on mourners by extremist groups. The love for Imam Hussein, however, is growing day by day.
Not only the threats cannot affect such gatherings in a negative way, but oppositely, the enthusiasm for holding such events is growing day by day. Security threats cannot prevent such holdings.
Imam Hussein's movement does not belong to Muslims, but to all humanity. The lesson he taught is also for humanity. He taught all of us not to give in to arrogance.
Imam Hussein and his companions were martyred nearly 1400 years ago after they refused to pay allegiance to Yazid, the tyrant of the time. Those who participate in Arba'in ceremonies believe that marking the day would help preserve the legacy of Imam Hussein, who sacrificed everything for the sake of Islam.
People in Afghanistan, like the rest of Shia Muslims, mark Arba'in by doing religious activities to pledge their allegiance to Imam Hussein. They say they would not follow the arrogant, as did not Imam Hussein. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The passing away of Queen Elizabeth II may be a sad day for a lot of people. At the same time, there are many who do not think about the Queen in positive terms. The massacre, for example, in Northern Ireland, or the chemical attack by British forces in Iraq, the role it played in a coup against Iran's Mossadegh government are just some of the things that have happened during her watch over in the UK. Now, in this edition of The Spotlight, we're going to review some of the atrocities. We'll look at the expensive funeral that has been held and look at whether that is something that comes at the wrong time for the people there in the UK, and ask, was her role really ceremonial? And at the same time, we will look at whether it's time to abolish the monarchy, as many are calling. First, let's talk to Syed Poor, who's in London, a correspondent who joins us to tell us about the ongoings of today. Well, Syed, you were out on the streets. I spoke to you earlier. Tell us what you saw and, of course, how this thing went down against for the ones who actually thought that this was still in excess in terms of the way that it occurred, whether it's the coverage or just the whole rituals that occurred throughout the past 10, 11 days.
This cover was the final act in a 10-day performance marking the death of the longest reigning monarch in the UK that glued millions of people to their television sets and many more onto the streets to pay tribute to the Queen. And we saw a lot of people also get emotional and shed a tear, but they had their own reasons. At the same time, there were millions of others who didn't do any of that for all kinds of other reasons. One, you alluded to, the excess of it all, the fact that the taxpayer has to pick up the tab, foot the bill, so to speak, for the expense that is involved, that the British government spare money has to grant the monarchy that's worth tens of billions of dollars themselves, tens of millions of dollars in taxpayer money every year to cover their expenses, such as their travels and their security, as well as the renovations of their palaces. That really has not gone down well with the public here, and the public at a time when they are of having to decide between heating their homes and eating in the coming months with the soaring cost of energy that is central to driving up the cost of living, creating a crisis that has affected millions of households in across the UK, from where I am in England all the way to Northern Ireland, to Scotland, to Wales. That has not gone down well with the public, who are questioning the relevance of the monarchy as an anachronistic, outdated institution that is still around in the United Kingdom. People who are saying that they don't understand the relevance of it in the 21st century, that it's now is the time. These are Republican voices and other people who are saying that perhaps it is the time to rid the UK of the monarchy once and for all. Whether or not that will happen, or how long it'll take for that to happen, is only something that time will show moving forward. Kabe.
Thank you very much for that, Syed Purza. We appreciate it. Of course, one of their Syed Purza from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me now introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Clive Menzies, researcher and political economy analyst, joins us from London. Also joining us is Sayed Mohammad Inayatullah and Drabe, who's an author and political analyst, also joining us from London. Well, I'd like to welcome you both. Clive Menzies, let me first start with you. We're looking at 11 consecutive days at this point, and so you're in London, so you could confirm this, and I'm wondering what you think about the passing away of the Queen. When we take a look at things like handwritten note from King Charles to his late mother, that's given extensive coverage. That was laid on top of her coffin. The Queen's corgis and pony await her arrival at Windsor Castle. Extensive coverage. A spider appears on top of a note card, or the Queen's coffin lowered into a vault ahead of burial. Do you think that this type of coverage to this extent is actually something that's necessary?
I also question how much of it is theater, because there are reasons to suppose that the Queen may have died a long time ago, and that this was the chosen moment to effect the transition from one monarch to the other. But it presupposes that the monarch actually plays a symbolic role rather than a more powerful role. And I think it is, certainly from the analysis that I've been involved with others over the years, wealth and power are synonymous. And the fact that from a cosmetic point of view, the Queen supposedly only has a symbolic role, I think the evidence suggests that the monarchy and its family have been much more involved in what has been going on for centuries, not just the current family, but also if you go, the role that they played in the 20th century has been quite pivotal in the way the world has developed. And that's what the evidence shows. In terms of the theater that we've been subjected to over the last 10 years, I think there are those who understand what is going on, and I would say that numerically they're in the minority. There are those who resent what's going on because of the artificially created energy shortages from the so-called climate crisis, of which the current appointee to the monarchy has been instrumental in perpetuating in various guises. And then there are a majority who I would suggest are subjected to Stockholm syndrome. They're basically enthralled to their abusers because the monarchy is as much a part of the panoply of power under which we live as the government. And in fact, arguably, the government is not in control, neither is the monarchy, but both are actually answerable to a higher power that is global.
Well, that's an interesting thing you just said there. We need to open that up a little bit with you. But Andrabi, our guests are also within that statement is saying that the role of the Queen or the monarchy in general is not ceremonial. Do you agree?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Does the guest say that it is not ceremonial, or is it ceremonial?
Not ceremonial.
Yes, absolutely right. I agree. It's apparently it looks symbolic and ceremonial, but it is not. It is an integral element of the British political power, British influence, global influence. It's an integral part of that. And the Foreign Office has been using royals as sort of ambassadors to different countries, creating goodwill and all these things. But apart from that, after World War II, when the empire has shrunk and there's not a huge British empire, Britain has somehow managed to maintain a power profile with the close relations with United States and other things. So this is part of maintaining a British sort of bigness in the world. having a monarchy, king, queen, this ultimately adds to the profile of Britain in the world.
Okay, let's, Clive Menzies, talk about the last sentence that you used there, that the government and the monarchy have to answer to the perhaps whatever or whomever that's higher up. Can you please expand on that for us?
Well, there is no doubt in the world today that money rules everything. Even those in opposition are controlled by money, because everybody needs money in order to live. If you want to resist and buy weapons, then obviously money is involved. And the supranational institutions are all controlled by money. So you've got the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, which is the central banker's bank. You have the IMF, you have the World Bank, and numerous other supranational bodies, including the UN and the EU. And these are all effectively controlled by money. And if you want to test that theory, then think of the countries that have attempted to resist that monopoly of power through the control of money. Libya springs to mind, because that's what Colonel Muammar Gaddafi was trying to do. He was trying to create an alternative African Union currency in order to map a road that was independent from the mainstream. But there are numerous others who have gone against the wishes of those that control money, and they have suffered accordingly. And just in this century alone, you know, there have been numerous regime change wars that I would argue, and the evidence would suggest, have all been fomented by money power. And if you go back into the 20th century, the destruction of Germany twice, the Russian Revolution, and the Chinese Cultural Revolution were all fomented by money power. And obviously, in this format, it is not possible to go into the detail of the evidence. But for example, Yale University had a representation in China, and Mao Zedong was an attendee. And as we know, Skull and Bones, which includes George Bush Senior and Junior, both presidents, John Kerry, a putative president, were highly active, along with the Rockefellers, in China around the time of the Cultural Revolution of independence. Dr. Andralbi referred to colonialism and the independence that has been gained. But if you look at most of the countries who've won independence, in inverted commas, they may have won political independence or the cosmetic illusion of political independence, but they have not gained economic independence. And South Africa, for example, whose resources have been plundered repeatedly over the centuries, continues to have or lack economic independence because money rules effectively.
Sure. Okay, well, we're looking now that the Queen has passed away, Said Andrabi, and you have Prince Charles that is residing, and obviously all eyes are going to be on him in terms of the way that he's going to interact with the government or not interact with the government, whether he's going to interject and or not, which all signs or all reports indicate that he will not. But the perception on the monarchy itself and the descendants, in this case Prince Charles, maybe can be reflected about on the Caribbean tour that happened years ago, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, Kate and William, when they went to Jamaica and they faced calls for slavery reparations. They were not really welcomed there, and the Jamaican Prime Minister said that his country was moving on. Do you think that that perception, based on the history that has happened and that the UK has had, is the way that Charles is going to be received?
Well, there have been about Prince Charles and now the King Charles III. There has been a perception that he is sort of he may not be exactly as the other monarchs are. And at one time, there was a perception here in Britain, in the Muslim population, that he is a good, friendly guy to Islam and Muslims. So those are all perceptions. But Prince Charles, the King Charles III, in his interview just 2-3 months back, recently, in an interview, he said that there can be only one king on the throne, that is, by which he meant that he will be a man of his own, and he will be doing things as he wishes. I think that Prince Charles will not be weaker or softer than his predecessors. There is a continuity here. It is basically the West and the British imperial power, and hegemony over the rest of the world, of which British Empire was the leading edge. That still continues, and that Prince Charles is aware of that. It's basically to ensure a complete hegemony of the world. And as your guest was saying about political independence and not economic independence, the political independence of erstwhile colonies, India, Pakistan, and others, being ceremonial, cosmetic, I completely agree with that. But I would add that it was independence means a comprehensive independence, political, economic, ideological, everything, which they have yet to get. They haven't got that independence. It's only a restructuring of the colonial and imperial, a new sort of world order, and nothing more than that.
Uh-huh.
So Prince Charles, the king now, I think, will continue the legacy of ensuring a global hegemony through the institutions and through the system that have been built over hundreds of years.
Claude Menzies, so many questions that I had, I can't really ask you anymore because of what you have presented. So I have to go along your belief or your obviously conviction in what you have said, out of respect to you, obviously. And I'm interpreting what you have said to be the centers of money that are dictating what's going on overall, like central banks or their heads or whatever else that spells the centers of money, whether we're talking about the Rockefellers, for example, or what have you. Now, my question here is, do you think that those circles or those centers of influence are going to support what so many have called, which have increased incredibly after the passing away of the Queen, about abolishing the monarchy? Do you think that that's in the cards because it doesn't suit whatever purposes they see, or they don't see that as a future for the UK? Do you think that that is the case?
I'm not sure, and it's not something that I think is particularly important, because I think what becomes clear, if you look at the trajectory since the global financial crisis of 2008, we've been on a trajectory towards economic collapse ever since, because effectively the Fed and other central banks kicked the can down the road in terms of dealing with the problem of over-indebtedness and this sort of Ponzi economy built on just massive amounts of money. And what we've seen over the intervening years, now it's 14 years since 2008, there's been a massive increase in global capital, both by money printing by the Fed, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, and it looks increasingly, I mean, the current rise in inflation was well anticipated by observers and analysts who were not enthralled to the current status quo. In other words, they could afford to speak out, whereas many of those in finance cannot, because it would be like Turkey's voting for Christmas. So we're about to head into a period of great instability. I think that the prospect of civil unrest across Europe specifically is, and possibly America and elsewhere, is significant, but against which there is a rising tide of, if you like, grassroots organization to fill in the gaps or to compensate for what is coming in terms of food shortages, energy shortages, lack of healthcare, which is particularly relevant in the UK. And these organic self-organizing structures are what are beginning to take hold. So whilst most analysts think in terms of geopolitics and should we have a republic or should we have a monarchy, I would say a plague on all their houses. I would say that its centralized power has had its day, and it's proven to be ineffectual in managing the world for the greater good, or most beyond a relatively small number of individuals. Most are disadvantaged by the current structure. And so what I see is less about talk about republic versus monarchy, but more about the crumbling of the current structure and its institutions, which have been self-serving and have not served the interests of the majority. The cosmetics that one sees through the mainstream media would have one believe that they're working for world peace, sustainable development, and all these buzzwords, but the reality is quite the opposite. And people, a growing number of people are waking up very quickly, which I've observed in England and elsewhere in the current year. And those institutions are being, albeit very slowly at the moment, but that will gather momentum as the chaos increases, by something much more organic and self-organizing.
Well, it's interesting when you take a look, Said Andrabi, at some of the social media reactions. You had one in particular that stood out that I'm going to ask you along the lines of what our guest there from London said about social unrest. And this person says, you're canceling people's appointments with the NHS. There are people who are dying from cancer, but they can't get their appointments going with the doctors because the Queen and the ceremony have to take place. And at the same time, people who are questioning why all this money was spent for the funeral, which just security-wise, we're looking at about $7 or $8 million, that is, of which the total cost might be maybe 40 to 50% more. And then putting into question, obviously, the whole monarchy rule. What do you think, and what camp are you in? Do you think that there should be an end to the monarchy, given the fact that you have the money factor that is associated with them, along with the either governance directly or indirectly, that people say is not warranted?
Well, let's acknowledge. You might have seen, I have seen, people have come out in large numbers to pay their respects to the Queen. And it was general people. And people had to stand in the queue for 13 hours, for 20 hours to come to Westminster and pay their homage. These are facts which we cannot ignore. And they are significant facts. Actually, I would make a point here, and that is, it's not the question of monarchy or republicanism. It's not that UK will be a monarchy or a republic. The underlying question, the basic rot is, the basic question is, modernity has failed. Modernity as a concept and in all its practical manifestations.
Sure. I'm so sorry, I got to jump in because we're fresh out of time on this. I do apologize. Our time has run out, but thank you very much, and sorry to have ended your statement. Sayyid Mohammad Aniyatullah Andrabi, author and political analyst, thank you. Clive Menzies, it's a pleasure, thank you. Researcher and political economy analyst from London. We had Said Purza at the top of the hour, correspondent from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Takwayi, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, you heard that 10 days after Imam Khomeini is going to Kuwait from Iraq and then leaving Kuwait immediately for France, his wife and family made preparations to join him in Paris. Before going to Paris, they held the martyrdom anniversary of the Imam's elder son, Haj Aqa Mustafa, and 4 days later left for Paris. Stay tuned for the rest of the story. The arrival of Imam Khomeini's wife, Lady Khadija Saqafi, in Paris was amazing and interesting to those who met her, as she was acquainted with French language. Haj Ahmad and some of the friends had come to the airport to welcome her. There was a student among them by the name of Nasreen Hakami, who was studying postgraduate in sociology. When the car carrying Miss Saqafi entered the streets of Paris, she started reading the signs. Some of her co-travelers were surprised, and Miss Hakami asked her if she knew French. The Imam's wife answered that she had learned it before high school and continued, ironically, "Yet you shouldn't expect me to help you with your lessons." In those days, many religious families were opposed to women's education outside homes. The polite and solemn behavior of Miss Saqafi attracted the neighbors and people in Neuf-le-Château village in the outskirts of Paris. She used to stand up for guests and foresee them up the exit door. When the visitors saw her respectful, sincere, and plain conduct, they would be astonished and ask if she was the wife of the man who had staged a revolution in the world. Lady Khadija Saqafi, besides warm welcome and hospitality towards guests, used to answer their questions quite calmly and patiently. This would make people interested in her, and they would become curious to know more about Imam Khomeini and his movement. One of the women who had met Imam Khomeini's wife describes her as follows. She looked very stylish in the chocolate coat and skirt, which was set with her cream shirt. She had a flowery chador on her shoulders with a headscarf which was fit with her coat and shirt. She was sitting on the ground, and we asked her to sit on the chair. She said, "It would be very bad if you sit on the ground while I'm sitting on the chair." At last, our insistence made her to sit on the chair, but the shame on her face showed her humbleness and plainness very well. Some of the visitors would ask political questions from the imam's wife. This would make it a little difficult, as she had to answer the questions on the one hand, while avoiding answers which would cause the despotic regime in Iran to misuse the answers. Thus, she would answer some of the questions subtly and smartly. Sometimes she would say with a smile, "I am a political scholar's wife and not he himself." Some of the questions were about possible differences in her life with the imam. She would answer like this: "Both the imam and I reach an agreement in many differences, as we recognize differences of opinion, and very rarely do we dispute." Once she was asked if she was worried as her security was threatened, she answered, "Firstly, security is related with feeling. A part of it is real, while another part is the feeling that cowardly people would feel even if with 100 guards. Thank God the imam is so brave that there is no fear in our house in the light of his bravery. Moreover, naturally, I am not a coward." Imam Khomeini's wife enjoyed lofty characteristics like her husband, and she didn't have any personal grudge against the Shah and his family. Thus, when the Shah was escaping from the country, she was impressed. Late Ms. Marzieh Hadidchi Dabbagh, who was in Paris in the last month of the imam's stay, narrated an interesting account on this. "The day when the Shah went, the sounds of people's joy and the slogans of 'Death to the Shah' were heard. The people in Neuf-le-Château, too, were happy. But when I said good night to the lady, Miss Safi, she was calm and quiet. And the next morning when she got up, there was no sign of joy in her face. I told her something to make her laugh. I said, 'Lady, I congratulate you as the Shah has gone.' She said, 'We should congratulate you as you have been tortured in the prisons of Savak. But I wish this did not happen. I wish he had listened to the imam's words in 1962 and had come to the nation so that he would not lose his popular support while going under the yoke of superpowers. I do not express happiness for the evil fate of anyone. I wish he had not become a Shah in the beginning and would not hear the chants of 'Death to Shah' these days. When I think of what a hard night he and his wife Farah are going to pass, I don't know what to say. I hope they will not commit any evil deed from now on so that their load of sins becomes heavier."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.